This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Forecasters in central Illinois aren't getting paid, but meteorologist Chris Miller in Lincoln says they're still on the job.
The main mission we have is to protect life and property through issuing forecasts and warnings, getting that information out to people to make decisions.
Forecasting the Forecast with GLT's Eric Stock. And you'll hear about a Blue Ribbon Committee tasked with finding McLean County's next top administrator. Plus, Who's Your Daddy stops by the GLT studio to play songs from their new album, Got a Mountain to Climb, with John Norton. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Forecasters who work for the National Weather Service in Lincoln have their own watches and warnings to face, financial ones. They're caught up in the federal government shutdown, and they're still delivering potentially life-saving information to the public. Chris Miller is a warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln. Miller also tells GLT's Eric Stock how the staff of 23 at that office prepares for a storm, such as the one that hit Bloomington Normal last weekend. He says his staff usually has its eye on a potential storm 5 to 7 days in advance.
We want to try to refine that for people for planning purposes, because people may have travel plans. Emergency management officials have plans that they need to know about the weather and share that with road crews and such, so they can plan for staffing. And so usually a couple days out, we try to get out a winter storm watch. A lot of times with that situation, people think, oh, that's a certainty where they say we're going to get a foot of snow. Really what we're saying is, watch, keep your eyes out. We're still watching the storm yet. 3 days out, it may just be hitting the west coast of the U.S. Again, lots could change as that storm crosses the Rocky Mountains, especially when it comes to snow. Just a few miles can be the difference between, say, a foot of snow and just a couple inches of snow. So we try not to get too deep into the details of it. Until we get to within, that 24 to 36 hour period prior to the worst impacts hitting, that's when we try to make the decision, are we going to issue an advisory for this winter storm? Because sometimes it's ice, too, and we're looking at, is there going to be enough ice potential that could cause power outages or significant travel issues or snow amounts. So that's when we try to zero in on the details of what we're looking at.
And we have to keep in mind that most storms, like the most recent one, don't follow regular business hours. They're evenings, overnights, and in this case, weekends. So how does that change your staff's approach when you have to be staffed 24/7?
We take that into account staffing-wise, and that's something, when we're in this job that we realize that essentially we're on call all the time. So the nice thing about winter storms is we have several days ahead of time where we know that this could be a potential and we can plan. It's when we get into the severe storms, tornadoes, flooding, when you're talking hours in advance, that we need to ramp up staffing very quickly. So we try to keep that in mind. We also try to keep in mind, like you mentioned, when is this occurring? A storm hitting at on a Friday during rush hour, whether it's morning or afternoon rush, is going to be a lot different than a storm hitting, say, late on a Saturday night or early Sunday morning or something like that. So we try to take all those things into consideration when we look at how we're going to do our operations here to get that information out to people.
And an added dimension now is the fact that the federal government has shut down partially. The National Weather Service staffers aren't getting paid, and for who knows how long. To what extent has that impacted your operations, if at all?
Very little, actually. We are affected by that, but we also know here that the main mission we have is to protect life and property through issuing forecasts and warnings, getting that information out to people to make decisions. Plus, we also, a lot of people aren't aware also that, you know, we do forecasting for all of the larger airports in Central Illinois, including the Central Illinois Regional Airport. We update that every 6 hours for pilots and for flights coming in and out. So there's a lot of different things there, but it's one of the reasons that we've been designated as a as an agency that's in the accepted status, because it's seen as a we're trying to do mission essential things for giving people information so they can make decisions to protect their property or to make decisions about whether or not they're going to travel, or, you know, it could be a life-saving information. So that's why we are still here with our total staffing during this partial shutdown.
So what does the accepted status mean?
It just means that a few years ago they called it essential. Mm-hmm. It just basically means that we're in a position where public safety or in the case of Homeland Security, TSA, that type of thing, where security is an issue. So anything related to safety or security in the federal government.
Are you getting paid, though?
No. Not at the moment. You know, and you've heard in the media reports where, various agencies, that's the case. That's part of the shutdown.
We are visiting with Chris Miller, warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln. Last month, after the last storms, which were more spring-like in terms of tornadoes and some strong winter storms we had, you had indicated the possibility of a milder winter, less snow, maybe warmer temperatures, what seemed like an earlier start to the season than most. Now, we had nearly a foot of snow last weekend and the makings of a potentially similar storm this weekend, if not here, possibly somewhere not far from here. Are we still on track for a possibly milder winter, or perhaps getting through winter sooner?
Yeah, you know, when we put the months of December, January, February, which is what when we put out a winter outlook, we include those 3 months, so roughly that 90-day period or so. When that's all said and done, and we still got to get through February yet, and we'll see where that goes. Overall, I think we're still going to be looking at that situation. I mean, December was, as you mentioned, after a pretty cold and snowy November, everybody was saying, oh my gosh, this is going to be a terrible winter. December was actually pretty mild, as was evidenced by the severe storms we had on December 1st. Temperatures in most of the Midwest were quite a bit above normal for the month of December. So we did see that. It's just now recently, as we've gotten into the middle part of January, where, we're seeing some winter weather. And, and we cautioned people when we said that. We said, overall, mild winter, that doesn't mean we're not going to get some snowstorms. It doesn't mean we're not going to get ice. It doesn't mean we're not going to get below zero. It just means that overall, when we look at December to February, when we go back and look at it, we are anticipating that the averages are going to be generally above normal for temperatures and fewer snowstorms or ice storms than what we would get in a typical winter.
On social media, we saw pictures of snow everywhere, of course, and another meme that caught my attention was the side-by-side comparison of 2 days in the same week. Maybe you saw it. We had 60 degrees on Monday, followed by a major snowstorm just 5 days later. Are these weather extremes becoming more of the norm, or does it just seem that way?
Actually, when we go back and look at that, we are seeing more in the way of these extremes, particularly in the last 10, 15 years. We are seeing more in the way of warmer temperatures followed by bitter cold. I mean, both ends of the spectrum, like you mentioned, rain and potential. We had some rivers in flood early last week, and then we're looking at a snowstorm. Look what we had in November, one snowstorm after the other in parts of Illinois, but then we shift into much warmer and then tornadoes in December. So we are seeing this trend. I've also seen it in the tornado data, where if you look at tornado information for the state of Illinois in the last 10 years, we see the most tornadoes occurring like we would expect, you know, in June and then May and April. But number four on the list is February. Number five on the list is March and then December. So, you know, we get more tornadoes in February the last 10 years than we've had in July and August put together. So we're seeing some shifts here in some of the, you know, warmer days in what we call the cool season. And those warmer, more humid days result in pretty violent thunderstorms, which can produce tornadoes.
And is this a symptom of climate change, the more widespread and less predictable weather extremes?
You know, we are starting to see that, particularly when it comes to precipitation, you know, heavy rain and flooding and these the storms with tornadoes and such, or some of the extreme levels of some of the winter storms we've seen. That's one of the things that the climate scientists have been predicting would be extremes. And a lot of times people think, oh, you know, it's global warming. That means it's going to be warm and nothing else. Not necessarily. You know, we look at temperatures here in Illinois. Temperatures haven't really changed very much. Now, if you look at temperatures in northern Alaska and northern parts of Canada, yeah, they are warming. But down here, the impacts we're feeling because of this whole connection between the oceans and the atmosphere and, you know, basically the whole northern hemisphere, we're seeing a tendency to see the extremes. Climate change doesn't just mean warming. It can also mean extreme cold. It can also mean extreme rainfall and extreme snowfall. So we're experiencing that, and we think that there's probably a connection there.
Insofar as the National Weather Service is a federal agency, its leader is the President of the United States, and the current president, Donald Trump, has taken a far different view of climate change than his predecessors. Trump has, at the very least, offered some strong skepticism that the data that the scientists have produced about climate change. Has his stance in any way affected how the National Weather Service or others in the government deal with climate and go on about their jobs?
Yeah, you know, with respect to our agency, the National Weather Service, and our parent agency, which is NOAA, which is all of the atmosphere and oceans, it has not. Despite, you know, whatever administration is leading the country, our job is not only the weather forecasting, but it's also collecting data. We collect the data. We make sure that the data, it makes sense. We quality control. We can't have bad data getting into the system. So we take that very seriously, so that when the others, when you've got the climate scientists and others that are researching, that they've got the good data to look at. So that's really where our job comes in, and where we've been for many years. You know, we've got in central Illinois, we've got weather records that go back to the late 1800s in various places, many places, if not the early 1900s. And so that's really important when we're looking at, you know, how are things changing, whether it's with respect to temperature or precipitation or snowfall or there. So yeah, we really watch the data to make sure that the information we're getting from mostly volunteers. These are volunteer folks that report to us every day. You know, it's backyard weather observations in hundreds of places across the state.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Chris Miller, warning coordination meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln. Now, it's a common refrain from the public that weather forecasters are always wrong, even though the data suggests they are correct far more often than many of us realize. Does the National Weather Service track the accuracy of its forecasting?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's our report card. You know, we watch the forecast accuracy, and in fact, it's automated to the point where I mentioned computer projections. We call them models that help us with the weather forecast, and when those models are off and we see biases in the forecast, either it's too warm or too cold, too wet or too dry, it actually will apply those biases as time goes on. So, you know, with high-speed computers, we're able to do that. And, that's something that that we deal with all the time, where people say, well, you know, oh, it must be nice, you can't get paid and you're always wrong. And, but when we look at the information that's going out there, I mean, just since, 1980, the 1980s, I should say, weather forecasting accuracy back then, the accuracy we were seeing at, say, 2 days out into the future is what we're seeing now 5 days out into the future. To put it in perspective, as far as temperature-wise, back in just 2005, not that long ago, about two-thirds of our forecasts for temperature were within 3 degrees in that first, 3 days of the forecast. Now we're up a little over 80%. So the accuracy keeps increasing, and I think why that perception is still out there is that weather's local. You know, if it doesn't occur in my backyard, well, then that was a bad forecast. Never mind the fact that it occurred a half a mile away. So I think that's also the perception. But also, there's a lot of information out there. People get their weather from us, but also local media, TV and radio, which get it from various sources. There's apps, there's social media, there's the guy standing in line next to you at the grocery store telling you, I heard we're going to get 15 inches of snow. And then when it doesn't happen, what they hear, then it's, oh, they're always wrong. So, when we actually look at the data, it is a lot more accurate.
That's Chris Miller of the National Weather Service with GLT's Eric Stock. Miller says there's an ongoing debate among meteorologists about how far in advance they should post snowfall projections in the forecast. He suggests don't trust any projections more than a few days out. This is Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Community Service Grant and from a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. These grants help fund Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and other programming on which you depend for news, information, and entertainment. Additional support comes from GLT contributing listeners. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Chicago gun violence gets a lot of attention, but another big Midwestern city has one of the highest rates of child gunshot wounds in the country, St. Louis. As IPR's Shayla Farzin reports, gun violence is having a lasting effect on children, their families, and the doctors who treat them.
When Erica Jones remembers her godson, Jermon, she can't help but smile.
Oh my goodness, he was a charmer. He loved giving women compliments. Every time he was just like the smooth talker, like the Billy D. Williams of the little kid department.
But it also hurts to think of him. Jermon died in March when he was just 7 years old after his younger brother accidentally shot him in the head while playing with a gun. When a child is shot in St. Louis, they're taken to one of two trauma centers, St. Louis Children's Hospital or Cardinal Glennon. Brad Warner, one of the trauma surgeons at Children's Hospital, helps care for them. Before every surgery, he stands in front of a deep stainless steel sink and scrubs his hands and arms with a bar of special soap.
Keep your wrists above your elbows, let the soap run that way.
Today, he's doing a routine operation, removing a cyst. But many of Warner's surgeries are much more complicated. That's because he treats a lot of gunshot injuries in children. Since 2011, St. Louis Children's Hospital has treated more than 500 kids for gun-related injuries.
The typical now is when you're on call at night is you come in for a, quote, trauma stat that comes over your pager. We'll get something like trauma stat, gunshot wound, six-year-old, ETA, 20 minutes. And that could be anything from a rifle going off to a drive-by shooting.
Warner says many of the gunshot injuries he treats aren't life-threatening, but some children have died on his operating table, some he can't forget.
12-year-old kid, they found a shotgun in the couch at grandma's house. He and a friend were just playing around with it, discharged and shot him in the abdomen. And by the time he got to the operating room, we couldn't bring him back.
Some of the gunshot victims treated at Children's Hospital are actually older teens. The hospital tries to limit their patient pool to kids ages 18 and under, but they will accept patients up to age 21. That means Warner and the other trauma surgeons sometimes have to pivot from caring for a newborn to treating an 18-year-old gunshot victim. Nicole Wilson is a pediatric surgery fellow at Children's. She estimates she's seen at least 50 child gunshot patients in less than a year.
The thing is, bullets are, they don't discriminate. A bullet hits a kid, a bullet hits an adult. The injury patterns are the same. The only difference in children is that they're smaller real estate. So kind of a blast pattern tends to have larger repercussions in a kid than it would in an adult.
For many doctors, the sheer number of child gunshot victims in St. Louis is alarming and frustrating, partly because it's hard to pinpoint a cause. Pam Choi was a surgery resident at Children's back in 2014. When she decided it was time to take a hard look at their patient data.
Having to take care of young children who are victims of gun violence, it's tiring and you want to see something done. And the first thing that you do to change a problem is to identify it.
Choi, who's now at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City, worked with a team of doctors to analyze the records of nearly 400 child gunshot victims treated in St. Louis over a five-year period. Of these, the vast majority, more than 80%, were male and African American. And a good chunk of the shootings, about 30%, were accidents. But beyond the statistics, each of those data points is a child and a family. Erica Jones, Jermon's godmother, also lost her adult daughter in a drive-by shooting in 2015. And she says you can't really understand what it's like unless you've lost a child of your own.
We talking about a child that we bore, that we carried for 9 months. We watched this child crawl, walk, talk, take his first steps. And that's a lot for us.
Jones adopted her 8-year-old grandson, Jakeem, after her daughter was killed. She says she worries about him every single day and that she's doing everything she can to keep him safe. I'm Shayla Farzan.
Let's continue now exploring the topic of child gun deaths. Last year, a 5-year-old from St. Louis found a loaded gun in a drawer while looking for Easter candy. He pulled the trigger and accidentally killed his 7-year-old brother. St. Louis pediatricians are trying to prevent such deaths by talking to parents about gun safety. But IPR's Sarah Fenton reports those questions are not always welcome.
3-year-old Isaiah is starting daycare soon, which means she needs a checkup and a shot.
1, 2, 3.
Aww, you okay?
Isaiah's doctor, Ken Haller, is trying to win the stone-faced toddler over.
Isaiah, come back, I can't see.
Before he leaves, Haller sits down with Isaiah and her mom for the part of the checkup most parents will recognize, in which he asks them about dangerous stuff in their house.
Are there things in your household that you're aware of that could be hazardous to or things like that?
Of course the clothes.
Electrical outlets, car seats, and...
Are there any guns or weapons in the house?
Okay. Haller is a pediatrician at SSM Health Cardinal Glennon Hospital and the past president of the state's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He says he asks the gun question at nearly every checkup.
Guns are a hazard, and for whatever reason you might feel you need a gun in the household, it's also something that has the potential to be very harmful to your child.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends doctors talk to parents about firearm safety during visits. The Academy's official stance is guns should be kept locked, unloaded, and away from where kids can find them. According to the journal Pediatrics, an average of 6,000 children are injured from firearms each year. 1,300 die from guns, and close to 80 of those, about 6%, are accidental shootings. Haller says he doesn't have an agenda other than to keep younger children from playing with a dangerous firearm and older children from using it to hurt themselves.
I have not said to anyone, you should not have a gun, or having a gun is bad, or having a gun is the wrong choice for you.
Many people agree the safety guidelines are common sense. Even the National Rifle Association says that guns should be kept unloaded and away from unauthorized users, like little kids. But some people think doctors aren't the ones who should give that advice. In November, the NRA set Twitter ablaze after it said doctors should, quote, stay in their lane after the American College of Physicians called for stricter gun laws. Paul Bastien agrees with the NRA, even though he's a little more polite. He owns Ultimate Defense, a shooting range in St. Peter's.
Ammunition.
Bastien's a former police officer who teaches safety classes. He stopped to talk on a lunch break during a day-long class.
Today is Defensive Handgun 1, more based around how to survive armed confrontation.
Bastien says pediatricians have good advice. He followed the same guidelines to keep his own kids safe. But he's also wary of what he sees as a doctor's political agenda. Gun accidents, he says, account for such a small fraction of injuries compared with, for example, trampolines.
When I take my kids to the pediatrician, one of the questions isn't, do you own a trampoline?
Bastien says pediatricians talking to parents isn't going to actually make anyone safer.
I think if they are incapable of grasping the danger of potentially having a loaded firearm within the reach of children, I don't think a pediatrician saying, what are you thinking, is going to change that situation.
But doctors say they have to try. Pediatric surgeon Bo Kennedy sees the worst of the worst in the ER of St. Louis Children's Hospital.
I remember a three-year-old little boy that found a handgun in the closet and put it in his mouth and pulled the trigger because that's what he did with his water pistol to get a drink out of it. And obviously he didn't survive.
He says many of the children he sees die because there's a loaded gun lying around. And talking the risk through with parents has become increasingly difficult.
Talking about guns has become much more of a volatile issue, though, I think, within the past 20 years. The National Rifle Association has made any conversation about keeping guns in a way that is safer, making that into a control issue.
But both Haller and Kennedy say as long as three-year-olds keep coming into their emergency rooms, they have no choice but to keep talking about guns.
It's Sarah Fenton reporting for IPR. After a break, another Blue Ribbon panel from McLean County government, this time to find their new top administrator. This is Sound Ideas.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Terry Crews joins us. We talk about his prolific career and his robust extracurricular talents. And then Jonathan Colton leads a music parody game that could literally save your life. Every song contains the number of beats per minute to correctly perform CPR. So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Saturdays at 10 a.m. on GLT. Find a program schedule at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Downtown Bloomington Indoor Farmers Market. Every third Saturday at the Grossinger Motors Arena until weekly outdoor markets resume in May. Local meat, grains, vegetables, baked goods, eggs, honey, and more. Details at downtownbloomington.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre says he believes his Blue Ribbon Advisory Panel of local stakeholders will help the county find the best candidate for its soon-to-be-vacant administrator position. But he tells GLT's Eric Stock the county hasn't given up on the idea of using a hiring consultant, if necessary, to find a successor for the retiring Bill Wasson.
I think the arrangement is better because of the fact that we have people involved that really know our situation and are willing to put in the time and give their expertise and experience that they've had in going through that. I think it's a third party involved. It's basically an advisory committee that can go through and take applications and maybe rank them for us, make some phone interviews if necessary. It gives applicants an opportunity to see also if we contact them and we say they're in the final pool of 5 to 10 candidates or whatever the advisory committee would recommend back to our search committee, they have an opportunity then to get a better feel on whether they want to continue with the process as well. The thing I like about it is also the fact that they can remain anonymous.
Do you plan to publicize a list of finalists before you come up with a final choice?
I think we'll take the recommendations of the advisory committee, the search committee. We're not going to publicize it, but you'll probably, being a member of the media, we'll find who's being interviewed. Sure, because it will be a public meeting.
You have one of the members of the Blue Ribbon Commission is a human resources manager, a former resources manager in Deanna Frauci. How important was that to have somebody with that HR background that Lori Rohrab in particular had mentioned as one thing that was necessary?
Well, I think it was important to have someone who can guide us, even at the advisory level, can respond to any concerns that we might have. You know, Eric, we made two changes in the stand-up committee in language for our job description, this evening, as a request. And so we want to do what absolutely is best. And somebody who's the vice president in charge of human resources at Country Financial, Mrs. Frauci, can definitely be an asset to us.
What kind of recommendation are you expecting from the advisory committee? Are they going to say, this is the person that we think you should hire, or are they simply going to give you pros and cons and let the search committee sort it out?
They're going to have a meeting, and we're going to talk about this, but it looks like to me at the time the idea, the process would be for the advisory committee to come up with a pool of finalists and rank them. Doesn't mean that the search committee will agree. We know that we've also, the search committee, a couple members said, what if we see somebody else in that pool that we would like to pull out? Yes, we will do that as well. After the advisory committee is finishing their process, there'll be other applications there, and if a member of the search committee sees someone that they want to also put in the finalist pool, we'll do that.
So with the deadlines and getting the language redone to have an application that is satisfactory, does that push the schedule back for when you hope to have this new administrator in place?
It could. It could. We want to be sure that we're doing the right things, we're moving forward and following the right procedures, and it will depend a lot, I think, on how long it takes the advisory committee to vet the applications and go through and maybe give our search committee some advice, and then how long it takes search committee to decide whether they want to move forward at that point in time or whether we're going to actually hire and expand it, feel we needed to expand the search and hire a professional firm. Hopefully, we still have that in our back pocket. Hopefully, we won't need to.
Do you have a sense for how much that will cost, or you're still waiting on proposals?
We were just looking at a history of some proposals and talked to a couple possible vendors, and somewhere in the range of $15,000 to $20,000. Again, it would depend on the extent of the search. One good thing would be that a lot of the preliminary work as far as the job description and the posting and the brochure and everything would already be complete, so that would save time and hopefully a little bit of money if we do have a firm.
Is it your sense from talking to county board members, some of whom were concerned about leaving this to the search committee, are they more satisfied to see the Blue Ribbon Commission having a role in this?
Well, I hope so. I think you would have to talk to the county board members, and I will as well, to get feedback. All I know is in the previous search committees, and I talked to members that were, like myself, who were on the board, we felt that the chairman chose a search committee. I wasn't on it. I didn't feel that necessarily that you can't have a search committee made up of 20 people to try to get the job done. It's a working committee. We're counting on the search committee to do a very good job, report back to the whole board, and they'll all have an opportunity. And I believe that's the only way to go with it, really, that makes any kind of sense to me. I didn't feel the necessity to go into the chairman when I was originally on the board 10 years ago and say, why wasn't I put on the search committee? I feel like there comes a point in time when the chairman has to make decisions. Our rules say that the chairman can appoint a working subcommittee of members of the county board, and also the chairman, by rule, can appoint non-members of the board to an advisory committee, and I've done both.
Did anybody ask to be on the committee that wasn't?
No. I chose the chairman of our regular working committees. We had two at-large people on our executive committee, and that would be 9 people. And I just felt at this point in time that 7 people, or 6 people, chairman and myself, would be fine, and they had experience, and so I just went with that.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with the McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre. After the first county board meeting of 2019, which is at a new time, moved from 9 a.m. on Tuesday mornings, the third Tuesday of the month, to now 5:30 p.m., any sense for what kind of difference you expect this to be, and for how long do you plan to see if this is the right fit? Might you consider moving back as they did at one time when they determined that they didn't see it was making a major difference in terms of the number of people who had access to the county board meetings?
I don't know for sure, but I believe the history of the county board was that the last time they did that, they decided to try it for 6 months, and I put a sunset clause on it. We did not. our when we propose this, and I propose it through the rules, when we approve the rules, we know any time that we feel that things aren't going well at this time, a majority comes in and comes to and wants a rules meeting. The rules committee could recommend that we take a visit at any time and change it. So it wasn't really necessary to. I think we're all going to take a look at it and see how it works out. And then maybe that's just the best way to go. To put a definite time on it, to me, kind of restricts the whole purpose of what we're trying to do. And some people may want to move back. It's a matter of getting into a different routine. I know it was different here today in this office and the things we're doing and tomorrow. But we'll adjust. And we'll see how it works out.
Look like attendance is about the same. Were you expecting more people to show up, or was that not in the thought process?
I really didn't know. I personally have always said the attendance of county board, full county board meetings, has more to do with what issues we're dealing with and who had a special interest in those than it has of just being there in attendance. I'm not sure. We'll look and see how many viewers we had as well and if it changed. And that's a good way for us to keep track to see.
One item approved tonight, the legislative program that you will be delivering to local legislators and a lobbying firm to represent the county in its legislative initiatives. One item on there was to move along the state toward a capital bill to fund construction in the state. And if the state is not going to do that, if it can give counties leeway to add to the motor fuel tax to be able to do that on its own. Is that something that the county would be prepared to do if the state says, okay, McLean County, you can take that on yourself and raise the gas tax?
Well, we'd have to vote on it, of course. Both councils have home rule privileges, and they have about 4 cents gas tax right now. And I think they would, they obviously have used that tax money for that. I don't know. We'd like to have that because of the fact that the motor fuel tax funds haven't been distributed with the same amounts for various reasons. One of them has to do with the gas price, and the other has to do with the usage. And the difference in what we, in our trends with electric, vehicles, et cetera. So we're not sure, but it would be nice to have that because our county highway department does a great job with managing the maintenance on our roads, and they've come up with some innovative ways, and they've scheduled some things out. But I don't think we are lacking in what we're doing, because I'm pretty proud of the highways we have in the county, in this county, but I think that they would help keep up on schedule better, and so obviously if we had more funds, it's always helpful.
Do you have any expectation that the state would allow McLean County to do that?
It definitely has to be a legislative bill. There's been some talk about that, with the new regime in Springfield. Don't know. Just don't know. Maybe they'll move forward in those kind of areas. And hopefully, whatever they do, whether it's capital bills or whatever, they will take into consideration the counties. And the cities are always obviously there. But we it would definitely help us. And the roads is a good example.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with John McIntyre, chairman of the McLean County Board. The county board did approve 4 more solar farm projects, bringing the total in the county to 18, but still waiting on the state to determine who will get those tax credits that sounds like are pretty essential to these happening. So with 18 approved, still the possibility that none of them will actually go up after all the time and effort that has been put into this. So what are your thoughts about the possibility of all of that work and possibly nothing to show for it?
Well, obviously they feel it's worth it to go through the process, and hopefully most of these organizations feel like that once they get approval to develop, if they get any kind of supplemental funding, that they'll try to go ahead and do this. I think it is something that's kind of a wave of the future. We're always concerned about farmland, especially in McLean County, productive farmland, and where these can go. But there are a lot of innovative ways in which these solar farms and places that they can be placed to where they're not taking away either that much tillable land or they're not disturbing our agricultural economy. So kind of just going to wait and see how it all unfolds.
That's McLean County Board Chairman John McIntyre with GLT's Eric Stock. McIntyre says his search advisory panel for a new county administrator is modeled after the panel he formed to help the county-run nursing home become more financially sustainable. This is Sound Ideas. Members of three established Peoria-based bands have come together as the Americana Trio, Who's Your Daddy? Former French Connection guitarist Dave Diefendorf's desire to form a trio led by him led him to Cindy Youngren, late of Southside Cindy and the Sliptones, and Dave Chastain drummer Larry Wigand. Who's Your Daddy stopped by the GLT studio to play some songs from the new album Got a Mountain to Climb for John Norton. Youngren says the band's formation was serendipity, as it came out of a conversation the two friends were having one night about the large number of members in the recently disbanded Sliptones.
He said, I always just wanted a three-piece band. He said, too bad you don't play bass. And I said, too bad you don't teach me to play the bass. And then he taught me to play the bass.
And that's what started it.
Well, that's the other development. You're a bass player now. How hard was that to pick up the bass? Were you an instrumentalist before? Is this?
Yeah, I have played piano and a little bit of rhythm guitar.
So you've got some background then.
Sure.
This isn't cold.
At one point, I was a music major here at ISU.
You never told me that. I never knew that.
Yeah. I was a music major and then a business major here. So.
Well, let's talk about that bass in a little bit. And I'm going to go to you, Dave. We're going to start with the song Old Raincoat.
Yes.
My understanding, talking to Cindy on the phone, is you basically, whoever writes the song is the vocalist for the song.
That's how it's kind of been working out, although we have a few things we've co-written that she sings. We're trying to get as much out of our harmonies and this and that as we can, too, because there's just the two of us.
I just absolutely love this song. And let's play just a little snip of it right now.
Great.
Wonderful.
I pulled in to Detroit town, I'm feeling about 100 years old. Need somewhere to hang my life. I come in from the cold.
This has a feel of a Levon Helm song to me. Maybe like the band or Levon Helm.
Yes.
Or there's a metaphor going on here, right? Rain equals pain. You're
yes.
pretty clear about that. Is
yes.
it the raincoat that's love?
Yes.
That's the protection?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes. It's the old raincoat. A friend of mine wrote this back in the day. It's the only song that we didn't write on the CD.
Okay.
His name was Keith Powers. He was with a band called Point Blank, and they came down and played the barn when it was going up on Galena Road in Peoria years ago, along with the James Gang.
The O. Nicole.
He ended up falling in love with a girl in Canton and quit the band and moved to Canton, which... I mean, it was great for over there because he was just a guitar phenom, but I'm not sure it was the smartest thing for him to do. But at one point, he needed a bass player, and I was playing bass back then, and we ended up writing this song he did. I kind of recorded it on a little 8-track, or not an 8-track, but a reel-to-reel.
And be careful, John, it'll grab you, because tomorrow you'll wake up, humming it, and you won't know.
Oh, I've already got that going in my head. It's an earworm already. It's real. I mean, it's got a great groove to it, too.
That it does.
So cool, yeah.
It does.
I literally
yeah.
have friends text me and say, I can't get this out of my head. Why did you make me hear this?
Oh, raincoat, we'll help you on a storm.
Name of the album has got a mountain to climb. It's new from Who's Your Daddy. The song is called Old Raincoat. And this is GLT's Sound Ideas in studio. Cindy Youngren and Dave Diefendorf from the band. I want to play a song now that, Cindy, you're doing the lead on. I'm assuming you wrote this song. It's called Cumberland.
Yes.
Just getting across town, not thinking about drama. I just try to get one thing done without reliving it all.
It's another great song on the album. This is fantastic.
Thank you.
First of all, what is Cumberland? What is that a reference to?
I did live a couple years in Nashville right out of college. Everything was called Cumberland there. And when you're new to a city and you're trying to feed yourself and whatnot, you struggle a little bit even to find your way around town. Every avenue or street seemed like it was Cumberland this, Cumberland that. And so when I think about having difficult times in my life, I consider myself kind of on Cumberland Street.
But I'm not asking anything from you. I'm trying to get through just one day. And now I got to make my way. I'm just trying to make my way.
If you ever know what the Cumberland River looks like going through Nashville, it's this big S shape, you know. So it's just a confusing difficulty, you know.
Well, kind of like Old Raincoat, which has some pain in it. It sounds like there's some pain in this one, too.
Yeah. So,
do you want to go there, or you just leave it a yes, that's what it is?
Yes, that's what it is.
The partnership itself, you guys are, Cindy, you were coming out of the Sliptones, but you've played in other outfits, and Dave, you play in a number of outfits as well. What is this partnership like for you guys? You hinted at that you kind of co-write sometimes as well.
You know, it just kind of started at a concept a few months back. We'd been talking about, let's do a CD like every band does, you know? And it's like, well, okay, you can't do a CD without some original music.
I was so amazed, though, at how quickly Dave just... He'd never told me he wrote anything before other than, you know, collaborating with other guys. You know, I would just show up to practice and he'd say, what do you think about this? You want to put some words to it? And I would, or we both would. Or then I'd show up the next time and he had written the whole thing. And I'm like, you're not going to leave any room for me to write anything? What?
I think the first song
on
actually...
it, I was impressed. So.
Did her and her... boyfriend went down to St. Louis for a 4 or 5 day jaunt, and I wrote Ancient History at that time. You know, we didn't want to redo somebody else's stuff. You know, that just, we wanted to have our own material naturally, like everyone does. The more she sings, the better I sound. So we try to get her singing all we can because she is the singer. There's no doubt about that. Oh, when I'm feeling so low, there's a place where I go.
The name of the song is Ancient History from Who's Your Daddy, and this is like a progression from a young boy who has a place to go that's kind of special where he can hide and just be by himself to a grown man now who needs that place and can't find it.
Well, that's a pretty good analogy right there. You know, when you're a kid, everything's new and bright and whatever, and the older you get, sometimes you get a little disenfranchised, or I don't know if that's the right word or not, or... with the world, you know what I'm saying? And I get a little cynical sometimes with some of my verbiage here and there.
But then you break into an awesome guitar lead and you get over it.
Well, and then it's ironic, there's no lead in that song at all, but they don't all have to have a lead, you know? I thought, that's all this needs. I got four verses, I don't need anything else, you know?
You know I'm always on guard, even in my backyard, but I just can't discard.
Eddie, won't you buy me a car?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Can we tell?
Let me play just a little bit. It's a fairly simple song.
It is.
Very catchy. Here, let me play it.
Eddie, won't you buy me a car? Eddie, won't you buy me a car?
Who's Eddie?
My brother.
Really?
Yeah. He lives out in the Denver area. He went through some tragic events with his wife. You know, she passed away probably 10 years ago. And sometimes when you want a relationship with someone, you're desperate. You know what I mean? You're desperate to get a relationship with someone. And he had a penchant for, I'm not going to say hooking up with the wrong people, but just trying too hard, I guess, you know. And like I kept telling him, Ed, it shows. You just reek of trying too hard here. I said, just, you know, let it go and it'll happen, you know.
And I think it finally has.
He's got a wonderful girl now. But
we don't want anybody to think this is about her, because it's not.
but for years there, it's the kind of how the story goes, you know. Met her at the grocery store, and now she's moving to my house, and I can't get her out, you know. Got three kids, grandkids. I think he did that three times, and we wrote him so hard about it, but he's got a really good sense of humor. He took it all in stride. That's what that song was about, Eddie, because it seemed like whenever they'd end up, they'd move out, but they'd have a nice car. So the joke out there got to be, hi, my name's Ed. Would you like a new car, you know?
And I have to admit, your wife, Diana, is the one who said to me when I got a divorce, she said, "Don't worry, maybe Eddie will buy you a car."
Eddie, won't you buy me a car? Eddie, won't you buy me a car?
Well, it's great to have you guys in here.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
We hope everybody comes out to the Copper Top.
Oh, yeah. I'm serious about Cirrus. I want a sunroof or a moonroof, or I'd even take a convertible, but it's got to be red. It's got to be real nice.
Who's Your Daddy members, Cindy Youngren and Dave Diefendorf, speaking with GLT's John Norton. Who's Your Daddy plays the Copper Top Lounge in Bloomington Saturday night. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois in the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and John Norton. I'm Ryan Denham. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas, so comment on our Facebook page, we're WGLTFM, or follow us on Twitter. We're all at WGLT News, and I'm at Ryan WGLT. Let's hear a bit more from Who's Your Daddy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's Public Media.